Hi everyone, if you've just joined us, this is the Retina UK webinar. I'm just letting everybody in, but we will start in just a couple of moments. Okay. Welcome everybody, good evening. Welcome to this Retina UK information webinar. My name's Kate Arkell. I'm the Research Development Manager at Retina UK. This evening, I'm delighted that we're joined by Dr. Nicholas Ponticos from University College London. Nicholas is a bioinformatician. He is a computer scientist who uses computing power to analyse large amounts of biomedical data and pull out meaningful answers. He's worked on the UK Inherited Retinal Dystrophy Consortium project, which was funded by Retina UK, and that examined vast amounts of genetic data from its participants to find new genes and mutations that cause inherited sight loss. Nicholas is now leading his own projects, including Eye2Gene, which is using machine learning to move towards more rapid and efficient genetic diagnosis in inherited retinal conditions. He's going to tell us more about that this evening. My colleague, Jane Russell, Communications Manager at Retina UK, is also here in the background to help manage your questions at the end. If you have a question, please type it into the Q&A box in Zoom at any time during the webinar, and we will ask the question on your behalf after Nico's finished presenting. So, Nico, over to you.
Hi everyone. Nice to see you all this evening. Sorry, I'm just trying to get my presentation up. If you give me a moment, and while I'm doing that, I'll just give you a bit more background. So yeah, I started working at the Institute of Ophthalmology in 2015, and I joined as Kate said, I joined the Retina UK Inherited Retinal Disease Consortium, which was a big consortium. Looking at finding the genetic cause of conditions which previously had been undiagnosed. So all these patients, the genetics data from all these patients had gone through the standard sort of genetics testing pipelines, but we, after even going through all these, they still didn't have a genetic diagnosis. So this consortium was really focused on identifying novel genetic causes. So I was helping a lot on the bioinformatics side. I was analyzing all the genetics data coming through. We were using what's known as next generation sequencing data. So we were sending all this data to get whole exome, whole genome. And that was really before the days that whole genome was like available in the NHS, which it's only recently become. And so we through this consortium, which included London, Moorfields, Oxford, Manchester, Leeds, and have I missed any? Okay, I think that's it. and now I think it's expanded to more sites. Basically, we were able to pool all that data together and to identify the genetic cause of conditions which were previously undiagnosed. So while working on the genetics data, I got very interested in also what we could get from data in the clinic. So the clinical data that was coming from the doctors, and in particular, the retinal scans. And those were not analyzed in any sort of computational way. They were just basically interpreted by doctors. And then that was translated into sort of clinical terminology, such as, retinitis pigmentosa, for example, or Stargardt or whatever. We were losing a lot, I guess, of information in that process from the retinal scan. We were not really looking at them in a sort of in a quantitative way, right? So that gave me the idea to start looking at them in a more sort of computational way. And in particular, with AI becoming a very important a very important area of research, I decided to combine the data coming from the clinical data with the data I was getting on the genetic side, looking at the whole genomes of these patients, and that led to the Eye2Gene project. So I've got some slides I'm going to share. I am having a one small issue of though at the moment with my PowerPoint slides. So let me try and sort this out. My PowerPoint has frozen slightly, and that's because of, let me try and sort this out for you. One second.
It's okay. We could always, I guess, try and manage.
I could. Yeah, sorry. Yeah, I could talk through my work of voice. Sorry, one second.
So I'll just say perhaps a little bit more about the UK IRDC. So that was a project that ran for a long time by Retina UK funding standards. It started in 2014, I think, Nico, is that right? 20, just
Yeah,
before you joined it. So it was a really, really big project that we've put a lot of funding into, but we feel that that's really, really important because it, as Nico said, it combed through huge amounts of genetic data from its participants and has helped tease out new genes, new mutations that are now part of diagnostic testing. So it's really made a difference to some families who previously wouldn't have been able to get an answer to the underlying cause of their sight loss. But that project was very, very reliant on computer power. On people like Nico writing bits of programming, I guess, to comb through all of that vast amount of data and come up with meaningful answers and work out what was just coincidence and what was actually what changes in the genes were actually causing a problem and what were just harmless. So, Nico, are you good to go?
Yeah, my screen's working now, right?
Yes, it's
Great.
perfect now.
Okay, fantastic. Sorry, I was having an issue with OneDrive synchronization. Okay, so here's some slides. I'll talk. I understand. It's. I'll describe the slides as I'm going through as well. So yeah, my project's called Eye to Gene, and the title is AI Assisted Diagnosis of Inherited Retinal Diseases from Imaging Data, and specifically from retinal scans. My title slide has in the background examples of retinal scans of various retinal scans that come from various patients who are affected by an inherited retinal disease. Inherited retinal diseases are caused by mutations in over 270 genes, a lot of which of these genes have been discovered through the Retina UK funded UK Inherited Retinal Disease Consortium that we're just talking about now. What I'm showing on this slide is some examples on the left side here of scans, retinal scans of patients who have an inherited retinal disease. Underneath each of these images is the name of the gene which is affected in those patients. So inherited retinal diseases are monogenic disorders, which mean a single gene is affected in a patient. So this is an example, for example, of an ABCA4 affected patient, EFEMP1, USH2A, which also known as Stargardt, sorry, also known as retinitis pigmentosa. ABCA4 is known as Stargardt, and CHM, which is choroideremia. And on the right, what I have here is an illustration of a different cells in the retina, and in particular the photoreceptors, which are the cells which are responsible for sensing light. We've got the cones and rods, which most people have heard of. And what we are illustrating here is that some genes are very much expressed, preferentially expressed in some cells. And depending which gene is affected, these cells tend to be more affected. And this leads to very different patterns of degeneration, as you can see from these retinal scans here. And what we're interested in our research is to identify what are the genetic causes of these retinal inherited retinal diseases, and in particular, the genetic diagnosis means identifying the disease causal gene. So that's what we mean. when we talk about genetic diagnosis. So I hope that's clear. Then this is a slide that we show to, Retina UK is convinced of funding this sort of research, but we show this to big funders like the NIHR, for example, to show them that actually inherited retinal diseases are something that is an area of research and of where the government should be funding more. And so this slide is really to illustrate the scale of the and the socioeconomic cost and impact in the UK of inherited retinal diseases. So there's around 30,000. This is an estimate because it's difficult to really know, but we estimate there's around 30,000 patients in the UK that have an inherited retinal disease. And what is known is that it is actually a leading cause of blindness in younger people, so in children and working age adults in the UK. It even surpasses conditions like diabetic retinopathy. And then because it's a lifelong condition, it has a huge socioeconomic cost to the UK. And this is obviously something that's an important, it's a big number, it's 523 million. And that's pounds a year. And that's a very big cost. And obviously that is important to convince, the UK government and the NIHR and funders that this is really a problem that they should be looking at and funding, right? Research into this. And then another big thing is that even though we're doing genetic diagnosis and thanks to funders like Retina UK, we are identifying the cause of more and more inherited retinal disease and finding new genetic diagnosis. Still, even after all this, there's still around 40% of the patients which do not have a genetic diagnosis. And that's really partially maybe because there's new genes we haven't discovered yet, but it's also potentially because some patients which we may think have a genetic a genetic condition, like an inherited retinal disease, may have something different. And that's sometimes difficult to tell apart. So in any case, this is a quite significant number of patients which are undiagnosed. And then the other big thing is the time it takes to get a genetic diagnosis. Now, we know the NHS is under a lot of strain, and currently the NHS is also transitioning into whole genome sequencing, as we mentioned, and this is adding additional time now to the time it takes to get a genetic diagnosis. So there's at least some patients on average have, if you look at all the patients, it takes more than 5 years to get a genetic diagnosis. So these factors are really, really important, and we want to be able to address some of these issues. So before going into how we address these issues, I just wanted to emphasize what are the benefits of a timely genetic diagnosis. And most people who are attending this probably know this already, but I just wanted to reiterate this, that genetic diagnosis is really important, for example, for family planning. So if you want to have a family and so on, it's important to know what are the risks of transmitting a genetic condition. Also, it's helpful for psychological support to know exactly what is the condition and to be able to give it a name and understand, how it could be potentially treated in the future, either immediately if a treatment is available or in the future. And also, how is it likely to progress? Is it going to be a stable condition that is going to remain stationary and not going, and sight is going to stay the same, or is it going to get worse over time, and at what rate? Then another important thing to consider is that sometimes these conditions could just be symptomatic, and in most of the cases they're not, but in some rare cases they can be symptomatic of something, of a syndrome which might be affecting other organs like brain, heart, liver, bone, so on. And these are very rare cases, but it's still important to know if that's the case, because then you can actually be aware of this and make necessary preparations. Then, of course, we know that treatment's being developed. It's true, there's not many treatments available yet. There's only treatments for, the only approved one right now is for the RP65 gene, but there are pharma is working hard on this, and people at Moorfields and in other institutions all around the world are working hard on developing treatments. So there's going to be a few treatments, we hope, becoming available in the next few years. So regardless, it's still even if you're not able to be treated right now, you're at least being if you know your gene, you can at least be recruited to a clinical trial for a specific gene therapy. So that's another reason why it's really important to know what your gene diagnosis is. And then, again, this is not maybe directly relevant to patients, but it's relevant to the healthcare system. That obviously, if the healthcare system knows and can give a specific diagnosis to a patient, they can put patients on the right care pathway, and they're not going to go. It's also relevant to the patients in that they're not going to go through tests which are not necessary, for example. So these are some of the key reasons why it's really important to get a genetic diagnosis. So we've gone through the reasons, we've gone through through kind of the scale of the problem of how many patients still don't have a genetic diagnosis in the UK. We've gone through why it's important to have a genetic diagnosis. And now we're going to try and see if we can, what can we do to try and improve the rate of genetic diagnosis in the UK and make it accelerate it and make it more efficient. So this is the ITGene project I mentioned. And what it does is, conceptually, it's quite simple to explain. You take retinal scans from patients, and here on the left, what we've got is examples of retinal scans. There's different types of retinal scans you can take. There's scans that look at they use different types of light, and they basically bring they highlight different features in the retina, essentially. So there's an autofluorescence scan, for example, that can show really deterioration of the retinal pigment epithelium layer, which is a very important layer which keeps your photoreceptors healthy. These infrared scans, and then these OCT scans, which you might have heard of, because these OCT scans are now available actually in high street opticians now. And OCT stands for optical coherence tomography. And basically what it is, it's taking cross sections of the retina. So it's giving you a 3D view of your retina. So it's a very detailed view of your retina. So these types of scans, we feed them into an AI, ITGene, and then the AI gives you a prediction of what gene it thinks is causing the disease, the inherited retinal condition, and also recommends future steps, such as what type of genetic test to do, and where to do your genetic test, for example. We're still working on what else, what other information could be provided at this point. And actually, this is where I think we're working with Retina UK in getting designing a report which would not only be useful for the doctors, but potentially also provide useful information for the patients. Another way it can be useful, this is a bit more technical, but this is more for the people interpreting the results of genetic tests. A lot of the time, people that are interpreting genetic tests, they have different pieces of evidence that they need to fit together in order to come to a genetic diagnosis. So they have the information coming from the actual whole genome sequence, right? But they also have the information coming from the clinic, the phenotypic data coming from the clinic. So the retinal scans, the patient history, and so on. And they may have some data coming from another from somewhere else, right? And so they need to kind of marry up this data in order to come up with a genetic diagnosis. And so a lot of the time, I mentioned the data that comes from the clinic initially, before we started this project, was just clinical descriptions like retinitis pigmentosa and Stargardt, which are just single words describing a very complex image, for example. So a lot of information was being lost in the process. So what ITGene is also going to help to do is to, if we give it the retinal scan, it's going to be able to feed that information into this sort of evidence-based framework for trying to identify what is the genetic diagnosis. So that's called a variant prioritization framework. But it's a bit complicated to explain, but we can talk about it after my talk. So that's the use cases. And now I'm just going to talk about the data that we used to train this ITGene AI approach. So the data we used is data of patients from Moorfields clinics, in the specifically the inherited retinal disease clinics. Now, Moorfields has been working with patients, has been seeing patients since for now at least 30 years in the inherited retinal disease clinics of people that you probably know, like consultants you probably heard of, like Andrew Webster, Michelle McLeady, Mario Misaji, and Omar Maru, and others previously that preceded them. And so there's quite a significant collection of retinal scans with genetic diagnosis labels that can be linked. And here, what I'm showing in here is three bar plots, and the three bar plots illustrate the three different types of scans that I mentioned. So the autofluorescence scans, the infrared scans, and the OCT scans. And then the individual bars indicate the amount of data we've got per gene condition. Now, what you can notice is that the first one, if you can read, is ABCA4, and that's Stargardt, and that is by far the most common condition that we find in the Moorfields clinics, and also in the UK, and I think globally it's the most common inherited retinal disease. This is then followed by USH2A, which is Usher's type 2, then followed by RPGR, best one, and so on. And what is also noticeable is that it drops quite quickly. And so what we have, even though we have a quite large data set, and actually we have probably the largest data set of these type of retinal scans and genetic labels, it's still a challenging data set to work with, because for some genes, we just have very few examples, basically very few patients who have that gene. But in any case, overall, after putting all this data together, we have 36 genes, which is admittedly a smaller number than the total number of genes, but it does represent at least 80% of all the patients with inherited retinal disease. And that equates to around 2,000 inherited retinal disease patients and 44,000 images. Now, we use this data of images labeled with genes, and we use those to train a AI, as I said, the Eye2Gene AI. And what the Eye2Gene AI actually is convolutional neural networks. Now, convolutional neural networks are basically neural, as the name indicates, neural networks, which are trained. And they kind of function like a brain in a sense that they are trained, they are shown examples of images with labels, and they are asked to predict, given an image, they're asked to predict the label. And if they get it right, then they are given a thumbs up, and they are, that answer is reinforced. And if they get it wrong, that answer, the weights in the network, the parameters in the network are changed in a way so that that doesn't happen again. And so this happens over many, many iterations, and eventually it arrives at a certain level of accuracy, basically. And that's what we do. We train it over many, many examples. This slide has three different, again, this slide has three different networks, because there's three different types of images we're working on. And the important thing is that we're combining the results of these networks at the end so that we have a combined result using the different pieces of evidence and marrying them up to come with a combined result. And after doing this, we get a top one accuracy of 66%, which maybe doesn't seem like a lot, but it is quite a difficult problem. And it's much better than if, for example, the network was always to predict the most common gene like ABCA4, because that would be around 33%. So, and I'm going to illustrate that it's quite, for doctors even that have been doing this for many, many years, it's a very challenging problem. And the top five accuracy is significantly better, meaning that the correct gene is in the top five, it's 85%. What's important when you do these AI models is that you validate them in other places, on other data sets that have not been seen at all before. So we went out and we did this. And so we reached out to collaborators in Germany And two other sites in the UK, one of which is part of the UKIDC, Oxford, but also Liverpool, who that is a kind of a new site they're working on inherited retinal diseases, and also another international site, Sao Paulo, and we obtained pretty consistent results across. So that was fairly encouraging that the IT gene is generalizing on data sets that hasn't seen yet. As I said, to contextualize the performance of IT-Gene, we also gave it to expert doctors, and we gave them a similar task. They gave them autofluorescence images, and we told them, can you pick out of these 36 genes which one might be the most likely gene condition? And so it was very, as I said, it's a very difficult task. They got a 32% top five accuracy. And on the same data, IT-Gene got 70%. So I'm not, saying this to make anyone, doctors look bad, but it's just to illustrate that it's a very difficult problem because these images can look very different and there's not that many examples to learn from a lot of the time. Another really interesting, this is a bit more complicated, but what this is illustrating is that the similarity between retinal scans is something that can also be captured by IT-Gene. And it's actually, this is what's called a dendrogram. And if you just, you can probably make out the blue, the green, all these circles here. And basically they're just showing you that genes, which you would expect them to be close to each other because their phenotype, they are similar in terms of the retinal scan appearance, they appear close to each other. So this IT-Gene is doing that, and it's showing that it is doing what we expect it to do in terms of grouping these genes together. But that's also really interesting because a lot of these genes actually that I'm showing, which are the labels around this circle here, they are actually new genes that we didn't use to train IT-Gene on. And however, IT-Gene was still able to identify groups and similar similar retinal scan appearances. So we think that can be very useful because if you have a patient that is undiagnosed, we do not know the gene, well, we can find, maybe in an automatic way, we can find another patient in another hospital somewhere else in the world that has a similar retinal scan in a completely sort of automatic way. And so we can match these up. And the reason why it's useful to match these up is this gives us more power to identify a potential new gene diagnosis, basically. So the more, usually when you discover new genes, it's not enough to just have one patient. You need one, two, three more patients. And if you even find, and if you can find some other unrelated patients as well, that's even better. And then that allows you to basically, put these together and then start looking at the differences in the gene and try and identify genes where there is, for example, more genetic variants that you would expect. And that helps you identify new genes. So that's something that previously has been done in a sort of more manual way. But now we have the potential of IT-Gene to do this in a more automatic way to match patients. This is a bit, this again, apologies, this is quite a technical talk. So this is a bit technical slide, but I will explain what it's about. You don't need to understand the details of this. But one of the challenges we're having with IT-Gene is that we, and in general with inherited retinal diseases, they are very rare conditions, right? And when you start looking at individual genes, you might end up with only like five patients in the UK or something like this. So this is very difficult for an AI system to learn from, right? Because we all, like an AI system, like a human, like anyone, we learn from examples. So if you only have five examples of something, unless it's something that's very different from everything else, it's very difficult to learn from. So one way we're trying to address this is by generating synthetic data. So people may have heard of generative AI now, which is something that's very topical. That's being used on the news. We talk about ChatGPT and being used for generating text and also for coming up with maybe completely new images. Well, we're using it to try and combine existing images and produce new images which are of the same type, so of the same potential gene diagnosis, but are slightly different. And we're hoping we can use these images to train the AI and to create more examples that the AI can learn from, basically, so we can better train the AI. So that's something, this is what this slide illustrates. And what these images are examples of retinal scans, which have been synthetically generated. Another thing which I'm working on, and this is more relevant for clinical trials as well, is to identify the actual features in these retinal scans, like the pathologies and so on. For example, we talked about the RP, the retinal pigment epithelium. We talked about the photoreceptors. Well, if we can identify the regions where the retinal pigment epithelium, for example, which is a layer, a very important layer in the retina, which basically helps maintain healthy photoreceptors. If we can identify regions where that layer of cells is losing its thickness and is deteriorating, that's going to be very important as well. And being able to identify patterns of deterioration between different conditions in a sort of more directed way, so that we can tell the computer exactly what to look at, that's going to help us not only diagnose disease, but it's also going to help us monitor progression over time. And in particular, in the context of clinical trials, that's really important, because when a new drug is tested, we really need to look at the pharma companies are looking at things in a very quantitative way to see whether their drug is working or not. So we're developing algorithms that can do that as well. So automatically measure, for example, ellipsoid zone loss or RP loss, retinal pigment epithelium loss, or photoreceptor degeneration, and see and quantify this across time points. We are also the AI to gene algorithm. We have deployed it online, and there is a website which is purely a research tool at the moment. We are not buying. It should not be used by doctors, and we have made it password protected. But we are very interested in people trying it, in particular doctors, and giving us feedback on it. So we allow for uploading retinal scans, and then the algorithm, then the AI runs and gives a prediction. And this is what this video is showing. So if you want access to it, you can email me on my email n.ponticos@uclac.uk. Kate can provide you my email if you want. So we've deployed a demo version online, and we've also got a system for transferring the scans as well, which is more relevant for working across multiple sites that want to share their retinal scans for us, for example, in the UK Inherited Retinal Disease Consortium. It's also a website that could allow for sharing of genetic data as well. Great, so I'm going to just wrap up, and then we can talk and answer. I can answer questions. So just to summarize, we've developed this an AI that can predict the most common causes of inherited retinal diseases to an accuracy of over 80%, and it can also identify phenotypic similarity. And what phenotypic similarity just means is just retinal scans that look similar in a completely automated way. But we need to do more work. We need to get more data, because a lot of time we only have very few cases to train our AI on. And we also need to, what we really need to do if we want to make this into something that can be used in the clinic, is to do more work on the regulation side of things. And that's what we're currently working on, and we're trying to get funding to do that so that we can start trialing it in clinics and see how it performs, and also how well it's received by doctors and by patients. And we're hoping that once this is developed, we can then deploy it in more sites. And this can mean that patients that, for example, where seen in a hospital or in a clinic where they didn't have any expertise in inherited retinal disease, well, they can be seen by this IntuGene AI, and they can receive that type of that type of expertise that would only be available in very few sites in the UK, such as Moorfields, Manchester, Leeds, Oxford, and so on. But we're hoping this can be widely made widely available. There's a website for the project, which is very easy to remember. It's www.itgene.com. You can go and have a look and have a read a bit. We've designed it for patients, so it should be quite hopefully understandable. There's also a web form there that you can fill in, and you can, if you want to stay in touch, you can contact us. We're always looking for patients who are interested in joining our patient advisory group. So please do reach out if you're interested. And on that, I'll just want to thank all everyone who's been involved in the project. In particular, I want to thank all the patients and their families who've consented to this research and to sharing their data and allowing us to do this work, and really hope that we'll be able to develop something that will be useful for everyone in the future. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Nico. That was really, really interesting, and a fascinating insight actually into how exponential AI could make our progress. And I was particularly fascinated by the sort of generative synthetic aspect, that AI could almost start teaching itself by generating images from what it's already learned, and then improving its accuracy over and over again. It's such an important project, because we hear over and over again from people who, as you say, are having a really hard diagnosis journey, have been seen in a hospital where the expertise doesn't exist, the ophthalmologist perhaps hasn't got the confidence in terms of ordering the right genetic test and going through things like that. So the idea that there could be something down the line that will make that so much easier, I think is absolutely music to our ears. Realistically, what do you think? I love the collaborative nature. I love the fact that you've got all this online and people can upload scans now. Clinicians can have a look and upload scans and things like that. How long realistically, though, do you think before it might actually be usable in clinic?
So we are applying for fund. So it has to go through, medical devices have to go through a pretty strict regulatory process to ensure that they are safe and efficacious and cause no harm and so on. And also in the context of the NHS, they also have to show to they have to be shown to be cost effective as well for the NHS. So we are applying for funding to do that now, because this funding is going to go until the end of next year, and by then we'll have a product which will be pretty finalized. The next phase will be another 3 years of funding, which we hope we are able to secure. And that's going to be a product development funding. And it's going to allow us to work with regulatory experts in completing all the documentation that we need to do in order to apply to a notified body like the British Standard Institute in order to get this CE mark or this UKCA mark, basically. So we're looking at another 3 years after 2025, basically after 2024. So I think by 2028, we can have something that maybe can be start being used in clinics. Obviously, we're going to be internally piloting it as part of our trial, and that's what the next round of funding is going to allow us to do.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of being used in clinics across the country, I think 2028 at least. And that's, I was going to say, that's also in a way that's good, because the gene therapies are being developed, right? So we're hoping that by the time IntuGene is available, at least one or two more gene therapies will also be available. And so we are able to not only give patients the genetic, help patients get their genetic diagnosis sooner, but it actually has a very concrete impact in that it will allow them to be able to get a therapy if it's available. Mm. So, so yeah, so that I hope that answers your question, Kate.
Yeah, and I think it's also, we have to remember that even therapies that aren't gene specific are potentially going to be narrowed down to a subset of patients for whom they work particularly well. And this kind of AI actually could direct people into groups. You can see it sort of potentially working in synergy where, you know, the AI has identified somebody as belonging to a particular subset even of genes, and that being a non-gene specific treatment that perhaps works particularly well for that. I can see all sorts of potential. We have had some questions sent in advance, and we've got one in the Q&A box now. So I'll read those questions out to you. If anybody else thinks of any questions as we're going along, please do feel free to type them into the Q&A box and I will read them out. So I'm going to deal with the one in the Q&A box first, actually. You mentioned the difficulty for AI when using only a small number of retinal scans to train on. Is there any extra benefit from using scans from one family where there are several members who have RP, but the mutant gene has actually not been identified?
That's an interesting question. So, so what would be the goal would be to be able to identify which patients may or may not have the inherited the gene within a family. If that's the case, then yes, it would be helpful to give a sort of I guess the background, which would be like, okay, if you give the AI, I guess, more information, like all these retinal scans from this come from the same family, and you can, the more information you can give the AI, the better, obviously. So if you can give it the mode of inheritance, for example, that's also helpful. If you give it the age of the patients and so on, that's also very all helpful information. And I think also if you can, it's a good point, if you can provide it also with information potentially that all these scans are actually from the same family, so they're likely to have the same gene diagnosis, even if it's a novel gene. I think that's probably what the question is about, isn't it? It's about like identifying a new gene diagnosis in a family that hasn't been identified before. Then that can also be helpful information, because what can happen is, depends on the condition, but if it's like different ages of onset, for example, within a family, some people may have a very early form of the condition, or some people may have a very late form of the condition. And so being able to capture that information would be quite useful. We haven't really worked on that sort of problem in a great detail. A lot of the time, the cases we do have some families, but we don't have a lot of big families. A lot of the time, from what I see is that the patients do not have a lot of known family members, and we cannot always get our hands on that data. To answer the question, it would help if we were able to get big families and retinal scans from older members, of course.
Yeah, this makes, I'm going to jump in with my own question. This makes me think a little bit of the RP17 kind of family. So you've got groups of people that can itogene support that in any way, or can that, is there any synergy there at all in terms of, because you've got quite large families there or large groups of people with a, you know.
Yeah, so if you were to so if you, it could help in finding another, so if you didn't know it was RP17, for example, and you wanted to find another family in the world that had a similar retinal phenotype, then yes, it could help for that.
Okay, yeah.
Or it can also help if you know it's RP17 and you want to find other families in the world that do not have the RP17 genetic diagnosis yet, but might have it, then yes, it can also help with that. You can also try and identify these patients. I think it's one thing, you know, when you're training, it's always good to have a lot of, to try and have diversity in your data when you're training an AI. It's like, you know, if you were, imagine you were learning what to differentiate cats and dogs. If you're always shown the same type of cat, for example, it would be difficult for you to generalize and to be like, okay, there's different types of of cats in the world than the one
Yeah.
I'm used to. So it's always good to try and have some diversity in the data. It's a bit of a counterpoint, I guess, to having only data from one family, for example, if they all
Yeah.
end up being very, very similar.
Yeah.
But in any case, any data is better than not having any, than no data, obviously. But I think that's really interesting, that a use case for what you described, for example, for identifying other potential RP17 families in the world where we have retinal scans, but we do not have their gene diagnosis, for example.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. Moving on to a couple that came in before. It's heartening to hear about the numerous research projects going on into finding treatments for sight loss. But do you think that researchers and industry are overlooking or not fully embracing AI? Should AI experts be more routinely integrated into research teams?
Yeah, I certainly think that multidisciplinary research is the strongest type of research, and it's really important to bring in different ways of thinking and skill sets when you're trying to solve any sort of problem. I think AI is going to, and more generally, like computational approaches to analyzing data are becoming more and more prevalent. Obviously, is the field moving fast enough? I guess is the question. I think it is moving in the right direction. It potentially could be moving faster if there was more push to these type of approaches. I mean, obviously, approaches rely on sharing of data and knowledge. If we're able to start building these big data sets and help and sort of encourage people who've been working on different problems to start working on this problem, then I think that would definitely be that's what we need, really. I think.
Okay.
But I think doctors are very receptive now to AI,
Yeah.
from at least the doctors I work with. I'm not. Again, I don't know.
Yeah,
I
I think
yeah.
it varies, doesn't it? I guess
Yeah.
if you're a researcher and a clinician, if you're a
That's
clinician
true.
scientist, I
That's true.
guess you have more exposure to the potential of tools like the one you're developing. Whereas, some of these guys who are practicing more routinely may not see that so much. Another question, a bit different. Is it possible for AI to help in any way for people to continue to work in jobs to do with statistics and maths and related fields that are very, very screen-based jobs? My son is a statistician and is losing his sight rapidly. Can AI help? I guess, is this a bit more around assistive tech and AI
Yeah.
in assistive tech? But I guess as somebody yourself who must work with screens all the time, you can see the challenges that people have if they've got sight loss and want to work
Yeah.
in this area.
I mean, it's something I've wondered about myself as well. What would happen to me? Because my work is so much computer based. What would happen to me if I couldn't see? Then, I mean, well, I guess I would have to rely exactly as you said on assistive technologies like screen reading. Or a lot of it would be I'm hoping and I mean that, we're hoping that brain computer sort of interfacing is going to be coming developing more and more, and that ideally, I mean, sometimes I come up with ideas when I'm walking or running in the park or something, and I would be like, oh, I'd love to be able to just that idea to just be recorded somehow and just transfer it to my computer so I can work on it. So I think anyway. So but seriously, I think that probably in the short term, assistive technologies like text read screen reading is probably going to be the most useful thing, and being able to communicate with voice to your computer as well, and hopefully we'll even get like more even sort of a brain computer connect a link to be able to You don't even have to speak, maybe at some point.
I guess right now it's a difficult challenge to overcome. It must be really frustrating if you're currently working in these fields, and I guess at the moment there isn't that technology that can necessarily bridge that gap, is there, between a visual stimulus, a visual data, and your work. So not an easy one to answer. Got one about a particular condition that came in previously. Is there any research into the possible genetic links to myopic macular degeneration?
So myopic degeneration is a is usually not a single gene disorder like an inherited retinal disease. It is a multi-gene condition, and I think the biggest risk factor is in the gene RMS2, I believe, or what, that's one of the genes. But it's usually linked to it's usually you link to multiple genes and genetic variants in multiple genes, not in a single gene. So it's a bit harder to necessarily pinpoint what is the genetic cause of a specific myopic degeneration. However, there's no reason why we couldn't, from retinal scans, identify, okay, it's this t it this is a myopic generation versus some different type of condition, for
Okay,
example. So we
yeah.
should be able to do that. We may not be able to necessarily pinpoint the actual gene from a retinal scan, because the link between the genetics and the appearance in the retinal in the retina is maybe not as strong as it is with the inherited retinal disease, where you really have a one-to-one sort of link.
Okay, yeah, that's a good explanation. We've got one more in the Q&A box, and actually I think that's quite nice timing because we've just got a few minutes to go and I've got a little bit to say before we finish. So this is a little bit more of a comment, and I guess we can both contribute to this, Nico. Our daughter was diagnosed with RP several years ago. My wife and I went with her to Moorfields in 2018 for genetic testing. Unfortunately, up till now, our daughter's RP cannot be traced to any particular genetic fault. So as you said, Nico, at the beginning, there are, still a significant number of people, or a significant proportion of the community who can't get a definitive genetic diagnosis, because that gene hasn't been identified yet. It exists, but we don't know for sure that it's associated with this type of sight loss. We haven't got, I mean, are the genes that we're looking for now the really rare genes? They're the harder ones to find, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. You're absolutely right, Kate, that it could very well be a new gene that hasn't been found yet, and they are harder. I mean, by definition, because we haven't found them yet, they are the harder ones to find. They are the rare ones. So absolutely. And it might be a case of, we think it's this one or it's this one, but we're not quite sure, and so we need to find another family that might in the world that might have a similar, a similar condition, and then we have more evidence that actually, we can narrow it down and say it's actually this gene. So that's what could be happening. Another thing is, it could be an inconclusive, it could be we're just waiting for the genetic result to come back as well, because of the NHS backlog. I imagine that's probably not the case here. By the way, I'm very happy whoever wrote this can reach out to me, and I can put them in touch with whoever to see whether they can look into it into more detail. Another thing that could be happening is, sometimes we get inconclusive genetic results because either because it's a new gene that we don't know about yet, or we have multiple answers in multiple genes that we know about, but we don't know which of these genes to pick. And that's what's known as, often we get those reports with these variants of unknown significance that are shorthand VUS. And so this is where maybe IntelliGene can help in saying, actually, it looks more like this gene than this gene. And so that can help. I remember I explained, maybe not very well, but I tried to explain that when a gen sometimes genetic diagnosis is just about combining multiple sources of evidence, evidence coming from the retinal scans, evidence coming from genetic tests, evidence coming from the patient's history of symptoms, for example, combining these and trying to come up with a coherent genetic diagnosis. So if we are able to, for example, use IntuGene to help us guide us in saying it's more likely to be this gene than this gene, if we've got these multiple genes, then that's something that can be useful. But
Brilliant.
it sometimes it's just difficult with these variants of unknown significance, for example, to know really of if there are variants that actually have any effect on the gene or not. And then you need to do experiments in the lab as well to be able to
To
tell
understand,
whether, yeah, the
what the
mechanisms.
effect is.
And exactly. So that's also work that, you know, you Retina UK has been funding, right, to do these mechanistic lab work to try and understand what is the actual effect of these variants. Yeah.
So yeah, thank you for that offer to reach out. As it is a Moorfields patient, that might be possible. So I'm going to wrap up. There's just a couple of minutes to go. A huge thank you, Nico, for joining us this evening. Such a great presentation. And thank you to all of you who have taken time out of your evening to join us as well. Retina UK holds a webinar during most months, and we'll soon be preparing our full programme for 2024. Keep an eye on our newsletters, keep an eye on our website and our social media for more information. And we are going to hopefully be kicking off 2024 with a webinar on the 25th of January, where we're hoping to be joined by a young man living with Stargardt disease and his mum. He's currently taking part in a clinical trial, and we want to hear about their perspective on clinical trial participation and talk about some of the issues around that. Retina UK is a registered charity. We receive no government funding, so we totally rely on all our wonderful supporters to enable us to do our work, to raise the funds needed to invest in groundbreaking research. There are lots of ways you can support us. If you're interested in taking on a new challenge in 2024 and you'd like to try a challenge event for fundraising, or you fancy organising your own event, please get in touch with fundraising@retinauk.org.uk to find out more about how we can help you. We'll be sending out an email over the next couple of days, which has details of where you can re-watch or listen to tonight's webinar, and details of how to book onto other events. We will also be seeking your feedback on this evening. Your feedback is really important to us as it helps us to shape future events. So once again, a huge, huge thanks to Nico. I hope you all enjoy the rest of your evening. Goodbye.
Thank you very much. Take care, everyone. Thank
Thanks.
you. Thanks,
Bye.
Kate. Bye.